This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. True crime is a blockbuster genre in, well, any medium. Books, movies, TV shows, and don't forget podcasts. All pull in the masses, horrifying and delighting us, and sometimes shaping our worldview in ways that bear no relation to reality. After all, how true is true crime? Does it really capture the complexity of the criminal mind, much less the criminal justice system, or convey the contexts of the victim and perpetrator in equal measure? Does it teach us anything at all? Emma Berquist is a young adult fiction writer and author of the recent Gawker article, True Crime is Rotting Our Brains. Last year, she was living in New Zealand, and one afternoon while walking her dog, a stranger lunged at her back and stabbed her multiple times. She survived the assault, but it fundamentally changed how she saw the genre she'd also avidly enjoyed. And in the Gawker piece, she pondered why it was so delicious, and also the hazards that come with the pleasure of consumption.
A lot of women that I talked to about true crime tell me that they're watching it for a sense of control, that it's a way of managing their fears, a way to like think about what they would do in those situations, which I don't think that that's a particularly good way to look at it, though, because it's not
terribly instructive.
Yeah. It's not going to give you tips on how to survive. But I do think that there is a sense of control in seeing these stories and how there's usually a narrative there, a beginning, a middle, and end. I think the problem becomes trying to maintain control can be ultimately very unhealthy. I was seeing this, you know, when I was dealing with my own PTSD, trying to impose control on something that can't really be controlled. And what happens is you get so caught up in making sure that you're in control that when something in your life inevitably does go sideways, it can really send you into a spiral.
In your case, it was a random event, but the assumption that hypervigilance can really deter these attacks is a kind of victim blaming.
First of all, it's a false assumption. There's no amount of hypervigilance that can save you from some sort of like surprise attack. And second of all, yeah, what I would call it is the victim blaming dressed up in empowerment, which is if I'm just smart enough or aware enough, I can escape these situations, unlike these other women who didn't. And, you know, what you're saying is that, you know, women who were murdered or women who had these horrible things happen to them should have known better or should have been more aware or should have been hypervigilant, and that would have protected them. You know, again, that's just blaming them for something that's completely outside their control.
Are you familiar with the study conducted by the University of Pennsylvania that found that the fear of crime and violence on TV have both increased over time, despite the crime rates declining, and that women reported more fear of crime on surveys than men?
Yeah. Again, I don't know that there's a direct correlation. I don't think it's quite that simple. But I do think that we are often unaware of the effect that the media that we consume on ourselves. We can see it in other people. We talk about our grandparents watching Fox News and things like that and how it can have an effect on them. But we don't always consider what we're watching and how it can have an effect on us, or what we're listening to and how it can kind of sneak itself into your brain and set up camp there.
Did you ever see that SNL song, The Husband is Going Out, and four women in the Saturday Night Live cast, their spouses are going out, and they're relieved because they get to...
I'm going to watch a murder show, YouTube, Hulu, That's my favorite thing to do.
Twin sisters got killed on a cruise in the Bahamas. I'm gonna half watch it while I fold my pajamas. Severed limbs found on a beach in Chula Vista. But I just kinda stare while I eat a piece of pizza.
They take up some bodies and do an autopsy.
Boring.
Wake me up when it's my child's in my proxy.
Women are, you know, the main consumers of it. And I don't know if women like watching true crime because true crime focuses on women, or if true crime focuses on women because women watch it and listen to it. And it's interesting because, you know, most murder victims are male, but most of the stories that we associate with true crime have female victims. I think that there's a kind of comfort in seeing your worst fears realized.
You had this horrible experience of random violence, and you are a true crime fan, and you decided to write a piece about the problem. So what did you want to impart fundamentally?
Really what I wanted was for people to just sort of interrogate their relationship with true crime. I don't want anyone to feel guilty about watching it or consuming it, because I don't think there's anything wrong with that. I don't want people to let it give them sort of the PTSD symptoms that I was struggling with. And I was seeing that happen in talking to my friends. I was seeing them have this fear that something bad was going to happen to them, just sort of like a low-level anxiety that they were just constantly living with.
How did that manifest?
Checking crime stats, having, you know, lots of security at their houses, thinking that they needed to have, like, weapons.
True crime is anecdotal. It's often overblown. It's like a newspaper that's all police blotter. But part of being a news consumer is looking for lessons, information, meaning from that stuff. Does true crime teach us anything useful?
I think if you're looking to true crime for survival tips, it's not going to be helpful. I think if you're looking at it for just information on, you know, maybe the justice system, that could be a little bit more helpful. There's a great article by Elon Green called The Enduring Pernicious Whiteness of True Crime. And he talks about how we should think more about what true crime can be and what we think about as crime. Because there are lots of ongoing crimes that we don't really think about as crime and aren't focused on as true crimes. Like when we think of theft, we think of, you know, people robbing a store, but we don't think about, you know, wage theft, which is a much larger scale crime, but we don't think of that.
Wage theft is when the employers don't pay you what you're owed.
Right. Why do we focus on, you know, the small sort of shoplifting crimes, and why do we consider that crime, but we don't think about these huge corporations paying their workers, and they usually end up getting slapped with a lawsuit and they pay a fine and we keep going. If we were to sort of reevaluate what we think of as crime, we could learn a lot more from it.
But we don't fear those crimes. Those crimes aren't sexy. I'm talking about true crime podcasts and TV shows as they currently exist, what we can learn from those. And then a follow-up, how could we make those better without destroying their appeal?
I don't know if there's anything to learn from them other than maybe getting information on how to prevent crime from beginning in the first place. You know, look at what caused, you know, people to act the way they act. Was it domestic violence? Was it poverty? Can we find solutions that don't involve just putting someone in prison after the fact?
Mm-hmm.
I think that probably is the way true crime could be helpful.
So in these true crime podcasts, maybe the real information comes from focusing on the perpetrator and what impelled them to do what they did.
When we focus on the victim, you're getting to tell someone's story and, you know, giving them a legacy. But what is the point of true crime? Right now, it's just entertainment. And I think if it wanted to be something more profound, then it would need to focus on how to prevent these crimes from happening. And to do that, you probably need to focus on the criminal side of things.
Let me read you about a book that I recently came upon that I can't wait to order. Here's a little summary. When 18-year-old Lexi foresees the brutal murder of a young woman outside of a club in downtown L.A., she's powerless to stop it. But then the girl's ghost appears seeking vengeance, and Lexi's swept into a dangerous search that could put her directly into the path of a serial killer. With a touch, Lexi can sense how and when someone will die. Some say it's a gift, but to Lexi, it's a curse, one that keeps her friendless and alone, and all that changes when Lexi foresees the violent death of a young woman, Jane, outside of a club.
Yeah, I did write that.
This is your book, Missing, Presumed Dead, from HarperCollins. It's steeped in violence, but it's a violence that teaches Lexi about herself.
I've always been interested in darker things. Like, I've always been a huge horror fan, and I wrote both of my books years before my attack. And I did end up killing someone with a knife in that book. And it's, yeah, it's just kind of strange how life works out. But, yeah, I try not to include violence just for the sake of violence. I feel like you have to earn the gore and the violence that you're using. It either has to be part of the world that you're building, or it has to be something that's going to fundamentally change a character.
When did you know you weren't going to die?
I think it was when the woman found me on the path, and her name was Rupali, and we were able to talk months after my attack and reconnect. I had collapsed on the path, and I was bleeding a lot, and I couldn't get up. I had managed to call 111, which is the New Zealand number for the paramedics, and they were on the phone with me, but I was kind of having trouble focusing and talking, and Rupali walked by me, you know, and I just said, please help me, and she took my phone, and she was able to talk to the paramedics and sort of direct them to where we were, and I think just having someone else there, having just another human be next to me, I think that's when I knew, it was like, I'm going to get through this. I'm going to be okay. There's help coming.
So you still consume true crime a little bit?
Yeah, not quite at the extent that I did before. What I'm more interested now is in survival stories, stories of people overcoming very extreme situations. I went through a period where I read a lot of mountaineering books, and I read a lot about Chernobyl. I read about radiation poisoning, which I think could be considered, I guess I wouldn't say true crime, but it's often a crime when something goes wrong that could be prevented. I became very interested in stories of human beings overcoming very long odds, because my attack really did feel sort of like a natural disaster, like a strange thing that just tore into my life the way that like a tornado or a plane crash would.
Has it changed the way you write?
You know, fiction is such a different thing. And what happened to me, I don't think would make a great story, because there's not really a satisfactory ending. The one thing that I really wanted to get out of my attack was a reason, was an answer, sort of why, like why me, why then? And I never got that.
They've caught him, right?
Yeah, they did. But he was, even in court, he said, you know, I can't give you an answer about why. He didn't even know why. So I never really got that kind of closure or that kind of narrative conclusion. And I don't think I could write something that was so open-ended. I like to tie things up a little neater than that. And that's really, you know, the main difference between fiction and life is that we don't get those tidy endings in life.
So you wouldn't write about yours, but do you think that the experience change the subjects you'd want to write about? I mean, would you write a survival story?
Oh, absolutely. And I did start one. And I also, you know, just finished a draft of a sort of killer in the woods kind of story. And that was really something that I started as a way to have a sort of cathartic outlet for the healing process. And I think I'll take what happened to me and use it to, you know, maybe put some more visceral scenes into my work, because I know what this feels like now. I know what the fear is like. I know what it's like to think that you're going to die. And I can maybe putting that into a character's mind can help me sort of explore it more fully.
Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me.
Emma Burquist is the author of the books Devils Unto Dust and Missing, Presumed Dead. You can find her recent article, True Crime is Rotting Our Brains, on Gawker. How about when tales of true crime are told by actual criminals? Coming up, mobster podcasts, now with real mobsters. This is On the Media.